It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Classic Short Stories. Today, Rocket Summer, from one of America's greatest science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury. I wanted to share a little bit about this story before we begin it. First and most importantly, it was written in 1947, which is 22 years before we actually sent a rocket to the moon. So the whole process is really coming from Ray Bradbury's imagination. This was just a couple years after the end of World War II. And after all the destruction and death that that caused, there was a lot of public sentiment around the world against war and rockets. And there was still a lot of fear of the unknown, outer space, and what dangers it could bring. We hope you enjoy the story. The first great rocket flight into space, bearing intrepid pioneers to the moon. The world's ecstasy flared into red mob hate when President Stanley canceled the flight. How did he get that way? The crowd gathered to make a curious noise this cold gray morning before the scheduled berth. They arrived in gleaming scarlet tumblebugs and yellow plastic beetles, yawning and singing and ready. The berth was a big thing for them. He stood alone high up in his office tower window, watching them with sad impatience in his gray eyes. His name was William Stanley, president of the company that owned this building and all those other work hangars down on the tarmac, and all that landing field stretching 2 miles off into the Jersey mist. William Stanley was thinking about the berth. The berth of what? Stanley's large, finely sculptured head felt heavier, older. Science, with a scalpel of intense flame, would slash wide the skulls of engineers, chemists, mechanics, in a titanic caesarean, and out would come the rocket. Yazir! Yazir! He heard the far-off, faint and raucous declarations of the vendors and hawkers. Buy your rocket toys! Buy your rocket games! Rocket pictures! Rocket soap! Rocket teethers for the tiny tot! Rocket! Rocket! Get your rockets here! Shutting the open glass-eyed frame before him, his thin lips drew tight. Morning after morning, America sent her pilgrims to this shrine. They peered in over the translucent restraint barrier as if the rocket were a caged beast. He saw one small girl drop a rocket toy. It shattered and was folded under by the moving crowd's feet. "Mr. Stanley." "Huh? Oh, Captain Greenwald. Sorry, forgot you were here." Stanley measured his slow, thoughtful steps to his clean-topped desk. "Captain," he sighed wearily, "you're looking at the unhappiest man alive." He looked at Greenwald across the desk. "That rocket is a gift of too generous science to a civilization of adult children who fiddled with dynamite ever since Nobel invented it. He got no further. The office door burst inward. A tall, work-grimed man strode swiftly in, all oil, all heat, all sunburnt, wrinkled leather skin. Rocket flame burnt in his dark, glaring eyes. He stopped short at Stanley's desk, breathing heavily, leaning against it. Stanley noticed the wrench in the man's fist. "Hello, Simpson." Simpson swore bitterly.
"What's all this guff about you stopping the rocket tomorrow?"
he demanded. Stanley nodded. "This isn't a good time for it to go up." Simpson snorted.
"This isn't a good time? This isn't a good time,"
he mimicked. Then he swore again.
"By George, it's like telling a woman her baby's been stillborn."
"I know it's hard to understand."
"Hard hell,"
shouted the man.
"I'm head mechanic. I've worked on this 2 years. The others have worked too, and the rocket'll travel tomorrow or we'll know why."
Stanley crushed out a cigar inside his fist. The room swayed imperceptibly in his vision. Sometimes one wanted to use a gun. He shook away the thought. He kept his tongue. Simpson raged on.
"Mr. Stanley, you have until 3 this afternoon to change your mind. We'll pull strings, and you'll be out of your job by the weekend. If not sooner."
And he said the next words very slowly.
"How would your wife look with her head bashed in, Mr. Stanley?"
"You can't threaten me." The door slammed in Stanley's face. Simpson was gone. Captain Greenwald put out a manicured hand. On one slender finger shone a diamond ring. His wrist was circled by an expensive watch. His shiny brown eyes were invisibly cupped by contact lenses. Greenwald was past 50 inside. Outside, he seemed barely 30. "I advise you to forget it, Stanley. Man's waited 1 million years for tomorrow." Stanley's hand shook, lighting a cigarette. "Look here, Captain. Where are you going?" "To the stars, of course." Stanley snapped out the alcohol match. "In the name of heaven, stop the melodrama and inferior semantics. What kind of thing is this you're handing the people? What'll it do to races, morals, men and women?" Greenwald laughed. "I'm only interested in reaching the moon. Then I'll come back to Earth and retire happily and die." Stanley stood there, tall and very gray. "Does the effect of the introduction of the crossbow to English and French history interest you?" "I can't say I know much about it." "Do you recall what gunpowder's invention did to civilization?" "That's irrelevant. You must admit, if there'd been some subjective planning with the auto and airplane, millions of lives would have been saved, and many wars prevented. An ethical code should have been written for all such inventions and strictly observed, or else the invention forfeited." Greenwald shook his head, grinning. "I'll let you handle that half of it. I'll do the traveling. I'm willing to abide by any such rules, if you'll draw them up and enforce them. All I want is to reach the moon first. I've got to get downstairs now. We're still loading the ship. You know, in spite of your decree. We expect to get around you somehow. I'm sympathetic, of course, to your beliefs. I'll do anything you say, except ground the rocket. I won't get violent, but I can't vouch for Simpson. He's a tough man, with strong notions." They walked from the office to the dropper. Compression slid them down to ground level, where they stepped out. Stanley, still re-emphasizing his beliefs. "For centuries, science has given humanity play toys, ships, machines, guns, cars, and now a rocket, all with supreme disregard for man's needs." "Science," announced Greenwald as they emerged onto the tarmac, "has produced, via private enterprise, greater amounts of goods than ever in history. Why consider the medical developments?" "Yes," said Stanley, doggedly. "We cure man's cancer and preserve his greed in a special serum. They used to say, starve a cold, stuff a fever. Today's fever is materialism. All the things science has produced only touch the body. When science invents something to touch the mind, I'll give it its due." "No." "You cloak your voyage with romantic terminology. Outward to the stars, you cry. Words! What's the fact? Why this rocket? Greater production? We have that. Adventure? Poor excuse to uproot Earth. Exploration? It could wait a few years. Lebensraum? Hardly. Why then, Captain, is it so important?" Eh? Murmured Greenwald distractedly. Ah, here's the rocket now. They walked in the incredible rocket's shadow. Stanley looked at the crowd beyond the barrier. Look at them. Their sex still a mixture of Victorian voodoo and clabbered Freud. With education needing reorientation, with wars threatening, with religion and philosophy confused. You want to jump off into space? Stanley shook his head. Oh, I don't doubt your sincerity, Captain. I just say your timing's poor. If we give them a rocket toy to play with, do you honestly think they'll solve war, education, unity, thought? Why, they'll propel themselves away from it so quickly your head'll swim. Wars will be fought between worlds. But if we want more wars, let's have them here, where we can get at their sources, before we leap to the asteroids seeking our lost pride of race. What little unity we do have would be broken by countries and individuals, clamoring and cutthroating for planets and satellites. Pausing, Stanley saw the mechanics standing in the rocket's shadow, hating him. Outside the barrier, the crowd recognized him. Their murmur grew to a roar of disapproval. Greenwald indicated them. They're wondering why you waited so long before deciding to stop the rocket. Tell them I thought there'd be laws controlling it. Tell them the corporations played along, smiling and bobbing to me, until the rocket was completed. Then they threw off their false faces and withdrew the legislation only this morning. Tell them that, Captain. And tell them the legislation I planned would have meant a slow, intelligent rocket expansion over an era of 3 centuries. Then ask them if they think any businessman could wait even 5 minutes. Captain Greenwald scowled. All I want to do is prove it can be done. After I come back down, if I can help in any way to control the rocket, I'm your man, Stanley. After I prove it's possible, I don't care what in hell happens. Stanley slid into his copter, waved morosely at the captain. The crowd shouted, waved its fists at him over the barrier. He sat watching their distorted, sullen faces. They detested him. The rocket balloon man, the rocket soap man, the tourists detested him. What was more, when his son Tommy found out, Tommy would hate him too. We'll return to our story right after these sponsor messages.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
And now back to our story. He took his time heading home. He let the green hills slide under. He set the automatic pilot and sank back into the sponge softness, suspended in a humming, blissful dream. Music played. Cigarettes and whiskey were in reach if he desired them. Soft music. He could lapse back into the dreaming tide, dissolve worry, smoke, drink, chortle, luxuriously, sleep, forget, pull a shell of synthetic hypnotizing objects in about himself, and wake 10 years from today with his wife disintegrating swiftly in his arms, and one day see his son's skull shattered against a plastic wall, and his own heart whirled and burst by some vast atom power of a starship passing Earth far out in space. He dumped the whiskey over the side, followed it with the cigarettes. Finally, he clicked off all the soft music. There was his home. His eyes kindled. It lay out upon a green meadow, far from the villages and towns, salt white and surrounded by tapered sycamores. As he watched, lowering his copter, he saw the blonde streak across the lawn. That was his daughter, Elise. Somewhere else on the premises, his son gamboled. Neither of them feared the dark. Angrily, Stanley poured on full speed. The landscape jerked and vanished behind him. He wanted to be alone. He couldn't face them, yet. Speed was the answer. Wind whistled, roared, rushed by the hurtling copter. He rammed it on. Color rose in his cheeks. There was music in the garden as he parked his copter in the fine blue plastic garage. "Oh, beautiful garage," he thought. "You contribute to my peacefulness. Oh, wonderful garage, in moments of torment, I think of you, and I'm glad I own you." Like hell. In the kitchen, Althea was whipping food with mechanisms. Her mother sat with one withered ear to the latest audio drama. They glanced up, pleased. "Darling, so early," she cried, kissing him. "How's the rocket?" "How's the rocket?" piped mother-in-law. "My, I bet you're proud." Stanley said nothing. "Just imagine." The old woman's eyes glowed like little bulbs. "Soon we'll breakfast in New York and supper on Mars." Stanley watched her for a long moment, then turned hopefully to Althea. "What do you think?" She sensed a trap. "Well, it would be different, wouldn't it? Vacationing our summers on Venus, winters on Mars, wouldn't it?" "Oh, good Lord," he groaned. He shut his eyes and pounded the table softly. "Good Lord!" "Now, what's wrong? What did I say?" demanded Althea, bewildered. He told them about his order preventing the flight. Althea stared at him. Mother reached and snapped off the audio. "What did you say, young man?" He repeated it. Into the waiting silence came a distant pshoo! Rushing in from the dining room, flinging the kitchen door wide, his son ran in, waving a bright red rocket in one grimy fist. "Shoo! I'm a rocket! Gangway! Hi, Dad!" He swung the ship in a quick arc. "Gonna be a pilot when I'm 16! Hey!" He stopped. "What's everybody standing around for?" He looked at Grandma. "Grammy?" He looked at his mother. "Ma?" And finally his father. "Dad?" His hands sank slowly. He read the look in his father's eyes. "Oh, gosh!" By 3 o'clock that afternoon, he had showered and dressed in clean clothes. The house was very silent. Althea came and sat down in the living room and looked at him with hurt, stricken eyes. He thought of quoting a few figures at her. 5 million people killed in auto accidents since the year 1920. 50,000 people killed every year, now, in copters and jet planes. But it wasn't in the figures. It wasn't in a feeling he had to make her feel. Maybe he could illustrate it to her. He picked up the hand audio, dialed a number. "Hello, Smitty." The voice on the other end said clearly, "Oh, Mr. Stanley." "Smitty, you're a good average man, a pleasant neighbor, a fine farmer. I'd like your opinion, Smitty. If you knew the war was coming, would you help prevent it?" Althea was watching and listening. Smitty said, "Hell yes, sure." "Thanks, Smitty. One more thing. What's your opinion of the rocket?" "Greatest thing in history. Say, I heard you were going to..." Stanley did not want to get involved. He hurriedly excused himself and hung up. He looked directly at his wife. "Did you notice the separation of means from end? Smitty thinks two things. He thinks he can prevent war. That's one. He thinks the rocket is a great thing. That's number two. But they don't match up. The rocket isn't a means to happiness the way it'll be used. It's the wrong means. And with a wrong means, you invariably wind up with a wrong end. A criminal seeks wealth. Does he get it? Temporarily. In the end, he suffers. All because he took the wrong means." Stanley held his hands out uselessly. "How can I make you understand?" Tears were in her eyes. "I understand nothing, and don't need to understand. Your job. They'll take it away from you and fly the rocket anyway." "I'll work on the legislation again, then." "And perhaps be killed?" "No, please, Will." "Killed?" He looked at his watch. Exactly 3. He answered the audio when it buzzed. "Stanley talking." "Stanley, this is Cross at Caltech." "Cross, good Lord, it's good to hear you." "I just heard the news flash," said Cross. He had the same clipped, exact voice he had years ago, Stanley realized. You're really on the spot this time, aren't you, Will? That's why I called. I like your ideas on machinery. I've always thought of machines, myself, as nothing but extensions of man's frustrations and emotions, his losses and compensations in life. We agree. But you're wrong this time, Will. You made a mistake today. Ah, come on, now don't you start on me. You're my last friend, retorted Stanley tiredly. What else could I do? Destroy the rocket? That would be negative. No good. Give them something positive. Tell them to go ahead, advised Cross, pleasantly enough. Warn them, like a kindly father, of the consequences. Then when their fingers are burnt, humanity might go down the drain, finished Stanley abruptly. Not if you play your cards right. Control the variables. There must be some way around them without getting yourself mangled. I'm ready to help when you have a plan. Think it over. I still think blowing the damn thing up would be... They'd build a bigger one, and they'd persecute you and your family the rest of your life, explained Cross logically. You and I may know that science hasn't contributed one whit to man's mental progress, but Mr. Everyman likes his babies diapered in disposable tissues and likes to travel from Siberia to Johnstown like an infuriated bullet. You can't stop them. You can only divert them a bit. Stanley grasped the hand audio tightly and listened. A great roar of copters sounded out in the afternoon sky directly overhead. The house shook. Althea sprang up lively and ran to look out. I can't talk any more, Cross. I'll call you back. They're outside, waiting for me, now. Cross's voice faded like a dream. Remember what I tell you. Let him go ahead. Stanley walked to the door, opened it, stepped half through. A radio voice boomed out of the bright blue sky.
Stanley!
It shouted. It was Simpson's voice.
Stanley! Come out and talk. Come out and tell us, Stanley.
Althea would not stay in. She walked with him out onto the moist green lawn in the open. The heavens were flooded with copters whirling. The sun shook in its place. Copters hung everywhere, like huge hummingbirds, swiveling, whirring. 500 of them at least, shadowing the lawns and shaking the housetops.
Oh, there you are, Stanley.
Stanley shaded his eyes. His lips drew away from his teeth in a grimace as he stared upward, tense and afraid.
It's after 3 o'clock, Stanley,
came the dull boom of words. In this moment, with the spiraling copter suspended over his lawn, over his wife and children and house, over himself and his beliefs, Stanley swallowed, stepped back, put his hands down, and let the idea grow within him. Yes, he would give them their rocket. He would give it to them. You cannot fight the children, he thought. They must have their green apples. If you refuse them, they'll find a way around you. Go along with your illogical tide and make logic of it. Let the children eat their full of green apples, many, many green apples, to swell their vast stomach into sickness. Yes, a slow smile touched the corners of his mouth, vanished. The plan was complete. The voice from the sky fell on him like an iron fist.
Stanley, what's your word now? How will you speak now, with 1,000 pounds of nitroglycerin over your home? What do you have to say?
The copters sank, malignantly. Thunder swept the lawn. Althea's brilliant amber skirt flared in the wash of it.
Will the rocket fly, Stanley?
From the corners of his aching, straining eyes, Stanley saw his son poised in the window watching him.
"Raise your right hand and wave it,"
thundered the sky voice.
"If the answer is yes."
Stanley made them wait for it. He wetted his lips with a slow tongue, then gradually, very casually, he raised his right hand, palm up, and waved it to the thundering sky. A torrent of exultation poured in a Niagara from the heavens. 500 audios blasted, cheered, exulted. The trees ripped and tore in the cyclone of energy and explosion. The noise continued as Stanley turned, took Althea's elbow, and steered her blindly back to the door. The little black jet plane dropped out of the midnight stars. Moments later, Cross was getting out of it, crossing the dark lawn, grasping Stanley's hand warmly. Made good time, eh? Inside, they downed their glasses of brandy first, then got to business. Stanley outlined his plan, his contacts, his psychology. He was pleased and excited to see an extraordinary smile of approval come across his pink, round face. "Excellent! Now you're talking!" cried Cross. "I like your plan, Stanley. It places the blame right back on the people. They won't be able to persecute you." Stanley refilled the glasses. "I'll see to it you're on the rocket tomorrow. Grinwald, he's the captain. We'll cooperate, I'm certain, when the trip is over. It's up to you and Grinwald, then." They raised their glasses. "And when it's all over," observed Cross slowly, "we'll have the long, hard struggle to revise our educational system. To begin to apply the scientific method to man's thinking, instead of just to his machines. And when we've built a logical, subjective world, then it'll be safe to make machines of all and any kinds. Here's to our plan. May it be completed." They drank. The next day, 2 million people spread over the rolling hills, through the tiny Jersey towns, sitting atop bugs and plastic beetles. An excitement pervaded the day. The sky was a blue vacuum, the copters grounded by law. The rocket lay gleaming and monstrous and silent. At noon, the crew ambled across the tarmac, Captain Grinwald leading. Cross walked among them. The huge metal doors slammed, and with a blast of gargantuan flame, the rocket heaved upward and vanished. People cheered and laughed and cried. Stanley watched his son and daughter and mother-in-law do likewise. He was deeply pleased to see that Althea did not join them. Hand in hand, they watched the sky dazzlement fade. The first rocket to the moon was gone. The world was drunkenly happy in its delirium. 2 weeks passed slowly. Astronomers were unable to keep an eye on the rocket. It was so small and unaccountable in the void between Earth and the lunar surface. Stanley slept little in the passing of the 14 days. He was constantly attacked by fears and confusions of thought. He dreamed of the rocket going up. He had seen men month on month walking in the metal shadow of their wonderful rocket, patting it with their greasy, calloused hands, loving it with their quick, appreciative eyes. If for one moment you let yourself think of it, you loved it too, for even though it symbolized wars and destruction, you had to admire its balance and slenderness of structure. With it, you could rub away the fog cosmetic of Venus, redelineate its prehistorically shy face. And there was Mars, too. Man had been imprisoned a million years. Why not freedom now, at last? Then he labeled all these fantasies by their correct name, Escape, and settled back to wait the return of the rocket. "The moon rocket is returning. It will land this morning at 9 o'clock. Everybody's audio was blatting. Like a yellow seed, the rocket dropped down the sky to sprout roots of flame on which to cushion itself. It fried the tarmac, and a vast deluge of warm air rushed across the country for miles. People sweltered amidst a sudden rocket summer. In his tower room, William Stanley watched, solemn and wordless. The rocket shimmered. Across the cooling tarmac, the crowd rioted, bursting through the barrier, sweeping the police aside in elation. The tide halted and boiled and changed form, layer upon layer. A vast hush came upon it. Now the round airlock door of the rocket jetted out air in a compressed sigh. The thick door, sandwiched into the ship hull, took 2 minutes to come outward and pull aside on its oiled hingework. The crowd pressed closer, flesh to flesh, eyes widened. The door was now open completely. A great cheer went up. The crew of the moon rocket stood in the airlock. The cheer faded, almost instantly. The crew of the rocket were not exactly standing. They were hunched over. The captain stepped forward. Well, he didn't exactly step. He sort of dragged his feet and shambled. He made a speech. But it all sounded like, coming from his twisted, swollen lips, was, Oh, God, dis-ease. He held out his great green fingers, raw, bleeding, for all to see. He lifted his face. Those red things, were they actually his eyes? That depression, that fallen socket, had it been a nose? and where were the teeth in that gagging, hissing mouth? His hair was thin and gray and infected. He stank. The hypnotic silence was shattered. The first line of people turned and clawed at the second line. The second turned instinctively to claw the third, and so on. And the television cameras caught it all. Screams, yelling, shouting. Many fell and were trampled, crushed under. The captain and his crew came out, gesturing, calling them to come back. But who would heed their rotting movements? The ridiculous souvenir seekers trampled each other, ripping the clothes from each other's backs. A souvenir? A scab of crawling flesh? A drop of yellow fluid from their gaping wounds? Souvenirs for Earth! Buy them right here! Get them while they last! We mail anywhere in the United States. The characters in order of appearance. The captain, the astrogator, held sagging between two astronomers, who were followed by 16 mathematicians, technicians, chemists, biologists, radio men, geographers, and machinists. Shamble forth, gentlemen, and bring the brave new future with you. The balloon vendor, in flight, jettisoned his entire stock. Rubber rockets floated wildly, crazily bobbing, bouncing the river of rioting heads until they were devoured, exploded, and crumpled underfoot. Sirens sounded. Police beetles rushed to the field exits. 10 minutes later, the tarmac was empty. No sign of captain or crew. A few shreds of their fetid clothing were found, partially disintegrated. An audio report 5 minutes later stated simply, "The captain and crew were destroyed on orders of the Health Bureau. An epidemic was feared." The sounds of riot faded. The door to Stanley's office opened. Someone entered and stood behind him and closed the door. Stanley did not turn from the window for a moment. 50 people injured, 5 of them critically. I'm sorry for that, but it was a small price for the world's security. He turned slowly. A horrible creature stood, diseased and swollen, before him. A captain's uniform, filthy and torn, hung tattered from the disgusting flesh. The creature opened its bleeding mouth.
"How was it?"
asked the creature, muffledly. "Fine," said Stanley. "Did you reach the moon?"
"Yes,"
replied the creature.
"Captain Greenwald sends his regards to you. He says he knows we can do it again and again, any time we want, now. And that's all he wanted to know. He wishes you luck and tells you to go ahead. We landed the rocket on the way back from the moon. First of all, up at Fairbanks, Alaska, outside the settlement. Naturally, during the night, things worked as you planned them. We changed crews there. There was a minor fight. Simpson and the original crew, including Captain Greenwald, are still up there, under psychohypnosis. They'll live out their lives happily, unaware, with new names. They won't remember anything. We took off from Fairbanks again this morning with the new crew and our act all rehearsed. I think we did all right."
"Where's the substitute crew now?" inquired Stanley.
"Downstairs," said the creature. "Getting psychoed themselves. Getting mental blocks inserted so they'll forget they ever fooled the world today. Then we'll send them back to their regular jobs. Can I use your shower?"
Stanley pressed a button. A panel slid aside.
"Go ahead."
The creature pulled its face around the edges until it shed off into its hands, a gray-green pallid mask of plastic rubber. The sweating pink face of Cross appeared. He wriggled his fingers next until the green-gray, chemically bleeding horror gloves sucked off. He tossed these into a wall incinerator. "The day of the rocket is over," he said quietly. "They'll be putting your bill up before the world legislature tomorrow, or I miss my guess. Carefulness, thought, and intellect will now get a start. Humanity is saved from itself." Stanley watched Cross walk into the shower cube, peel, and switch on the spray. He turned to the window again. 2 billion people were thinking tonight. He knew what they were thinking. Outside, he heard the explosion as the health department blew up the great rocket. That was all. The sound of water on the shower tiles was a good, clean sound. Thanks for joining us for Rocket Summer by Ray Bradbury. If you enjoy our stories here at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales, please do send us a review, and please do share with your friends. And by the way, we're now on Twitter, and for those of you who do follow Twitter, we're at 1001 Podcast. That address is at 1001 Podcast. And basically, going forward, we'll be using Twitter to announce specific episodes and hopefully to get some conversation started. We'll see how that works. But if you are a Twitter follower, we really could use your follow there. Our address is at 1001 Podcast. Thanks for joining us today for this Ray Bradbury story. Many more to come here at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll be back soon.